Now, I assume this is now on since I have properly pushed the record button. As you see, all these newfangled devices. What I hope to do this morning is to kind of carry on with what I started at the feast in Hollister. At that time, I brought out what life was like to some degree before the flood, what the Hebrew indicated it was. Well, now we're going to carry on, especially in Genesis 10 and 11, with what happened after the flood. But before I do, I want to illustrate through two specific scriptures where the Hebrew can help out, and sometimes where the Hebrew is meaningless. Because I remember reading several scriptures, and I thought, well, what does the Hebrew really say? So I went to the scholars, I looked at Rashi, I looked at Maimonides, and what did I find? Hebrew obscure. Hebrew not clear. Then I thought to myself, well, you don't know any more than I do. Which is true. I mean, you got to realize something. We're going back 3,000, 4,000 years. That's a long time. So some of these Hebrew words, you know, they get messed up. So we're going to start out first. We're going to start out in Isaiah 45. This is one that was an enigma to me for a long time until I finally got smart and read the Hebrew. Then it was very clear what it really meant. Okay? This is one of those chapters where God is talking about the first and the last and all the things that he is and all the things that he does. And then we have this enigmatic phrase in verse 7. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. How does God create evil? An interesting phrase. Are we going to assume that God creates literally that which is evil? Oh, I doubt that very much. Well, you see, it means he creates things that have the potential to become evil. This tortuous explanation. No, that's not what it means either. It all boils down to what we mean by create and evil. Now, sure enough, the Hebrew word for create is bara. And you'll find that in Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created, bara, the heavens and the earth. But an English, I should say, a Hebrew word is like an English word, or a French word, or a German word. It means more than one thing. Run, R-U-N. I can run down the street. There could be a run on the bank. I could be a great baseball slugger and drive in runs. I can run this operation. It's all the same, but different meanings. Well, the Hebrew word has different meanings too. Bara also means to dispatch or send forth. Now that's important. And the word ra, which is the Hebrew word for evil, yes, the tree of good and evil, that's ra, but it also means just plain bad, calamity, destruction. So what do we really have here? In Hebrew for ra, it means bad. Today in Hebrew, if you were in Israel and you saying to someone, Maslamcha, how are you? He would say, lo ra. Lo, meaning not. Ra, bad. Just means bad. Now, it can mean evil, but it can always simply mean not good. So here we have the English phrase, have you ever heard of it? Evil tidings, an evil day. Well, you wouldn't say evil tidings. What would you say? Bad news. And it is the same thing. So when you look at it, you look at the context, and what do you find going back to the end of Isaiah 44, 28, talking about Cyrus? And then you read the first seven or eight chapters, verses of 45, talking about Cyrus again, his anointed. He's opening up the gates of Babylon to Cyrus and about his house. And so what God is saying, I am dispatching evil, calamity, upon the city of Babylon for its sins in the person of Cyrus and his Persian army. That's all this verse is saying. And if you really want to get a flavor for it, go over to Romans chapter 2, and you will pick it up in verse 6. Romans 2, verse 6. God is saying, Paul is saying of God, who will render to each one according to his works. On the one hand, to those who with patient endurance in good works are seeking glory and honor and immortality, he's going to give them eternal life. On the other hand, to those who are contentious, who disobey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, he's going to send forth indignation and wrath. So that's all Isaiah 45, verse 7 is saying. I send forth evil if you rebel against me. Nothing more, nothing less. Let me see if I've made sure I've covered everything I wanted to there. Yes, I think I have. Now, there's another area which was fascinating to me, and I could never fully understand it. Until, once again, silly me. Why don't you read what the Hebrew says? You just might find out. Numbers 22. We remember the story of what we call Balaam, but it's really Bil'am in the Hebrew. The Israelites were coming across. Balak was the king of the Moabites, and he's afraid of Israel, so he sends forth to Bil'am and says, come, help me, curse this people. You have to remember, Bil'am was the great Pethor. He was the great Pontifex Maximus of that part of the world. And Balak knew that if he could just get this man to curse the Israelites, they would be cursed. So he calls for him. Now we know the story, what happened. You can read the entire chapter 22. The servants came to him. Bil'am says, wait, I've got to seek the Lord because I cannot do anything unless the Lord allows me to do so. God says, no, don't go. So people went back to Balak. Well, Balak refuses, no. So he says, I've got to send more people. So he sent them again. And Balaam says, this time we find here in verse 18, and Bil'am answered and said to the servants of Balak, if Balak would give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of the Lord, my God, to do less or more. Stay now, and I'll find out. So God says to Bil'am, if the men come to call you, rise up and go with them. But only the word which I shall say to you, that you shall do. So Bil'am rose up, he went with them. And then verse 22, God's anger was kindled against him. Oh, why is that? You can read the rest of the story. The donkey's on his way carrying Bil'am, and there's the angel of the Lord with a sword in his hand. Of course, Bil'am can't see that, but the donkey can. So the donkey goes off into the field. And Bil'am is furious. And then he goes by some hedgerows, so to speak, olive trees, or whatever the vegetation was, the vineyards. And Bil'am has his foot crushed, and he's furious again at the donkey, and he starts to beat the donkey when the donkey just drops. Finally, we have God, the angel, opening up the eyes of Bil'am. And, of course, the angel says to him, your way is perverse against me. So what is all this? Was God suffering from dementia? He didn't know the night before he said to go with him. Now because he does go with him, he's angry? Well, the answer is, in those words with, look at verse 20. If the men come to call you, rise up, go with them. Now remember that word with. The next verse, Balaam rose up and saddled his donkey and went with the rulers. The key is, they're two different Hebrew words with very different significant meanings. When God said go with them, he used the word et. Now et means to accompany. Go along with them. Hey, walk with them if you'd like. It's okay. You're working, you're getting up at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you're going to go home. And so you're walking with some of the people. You're etting with them. And you get to your car, he gets to his car, and you drive off. On the other hand, when Balaam said or indicated he was going with them, that is the word im. Now, im is a whole different word. Im means to be part and parcel of. Im means to be with you in every sense of the word, to join with you in cursing Israel. God never authorized Bil'am to go and curse Israel. Never. Now you know why God was so furious with Bil'am, because he was going to curse Israel when God never gave him permission to do that. Now, if you read it in the English, as I did for years, I never knew what it really meant, because I never bothered with the Hebrew. In fact, All the times in chapter 22, you will find the word with translated as im. But the one time where God tells Balak specifically to go, it is et. Now, it's true, later on, God did say, go im with them. But then it was clear that Bilam was not given permission to curse Israel. Only what I say to you. Well, I wanted to give you those two specifics to show where Hebrew really helps. Now we're going to cover the meat of what I hope to bring this morning. We're going to Genesis 10, and we're going to spend most of our time in Genesis 10 and Genesis 11. This is what is known as, by some people anyway, the chapter of the begats. Everybody's begetting somebody. And so we come to verse 8 of Genesis 10. And Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter. And here we've translated against the Lord. And I think that's a valid translation. Wherefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter against the Lord. Furthermore, if you ever go to 1 Chronicles 1, you don't need to turn there, but you might want to jot it down. It says in 1 Chronicles 1, verse 10, and Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be mighty in the earth. Now that's four times God calls Nimrod mighty. Now he doesn't do it for nothing. This guy is the one man who organized the great rebellion against God after the flood. And if we understand the Hebrew, that's exactly what it's telling us. Although I read right over it for I don't know how many years. I knew Nimrod was important. I just didn't realize how big he was. So what we find here is he began to be a mighty one in the earth. Now, he began can also be translated first. And I want you to listen to the pronunciation of the word began. Let me get out my interlinear here so I can read it properly for you. And it is hechel, hechel. Now listen to that pronunciation, hechel, because we're going to see that those root letters are the same root letters that we're going to find in another word. And that's going to be in Leviticus 10, verse 10. If I come to it here, here we are. It's talking about distinguishing between the holy and the unholy, or the profane. And the word for unholy or profane is hachol. Hechel, hachol. Now, the basic principle here, Hebrew is a unique language, and I suppose every language is unique, but the meaning is found in the three basic root letters of each word. And if those root letters are the same, then you have a connection. In English, we have 26 letters, vowels and consonants. In Hebrew, we do not. We have 22 consonants. We have no vowel letters. The vowels are determined by the dots or the slashes that you find above or underneath it. But when the root letters are the same, then there's a connection. So what is this telling us? He was first to lead the people away from God, because hachol can be profane, secular. He was leading a revolutionary rebellion against God. Wherefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter, against. And the word against is lifnei, which is translated before in the King James. It could be in opposition to, opposed to, instead of, in place of. All of those meanings can be used. So here is Nimrod rebelling against God. And he was a hunter. Well, everyone's a hunter. But remember what Jesus told his disciples, Peter and Andrew and the sons of Zebedee, I will make you fishers of men. Nimrod is making people hunters of men in order to gain strength in his rebellion against the way of God. He says, we're going to have a new civilization here. In fact, the theme song might well be John Lennon's Imagine. Beautiful song. I love it. It's a beautiful song. Words are terrible, but it's a beautiful song. Imagine, no heaven, no hell, no God, just people. And well, this was Nimrod. Now, Nimrod's name, by the way, what I said about being elevated up here earlier, one of the meanings of Nimrod is get down. You are down, I am up. Therefore, you do as I say. You would never get that in English, but you do get it in the Hebrew. So Nimrod is the elevated one, and his system has come down today. But this is the origin of it. Now, let me go further here. I want to make sure I follow in my precise order that I laid out for you. It may take me about 60 seconds or so, but we are going to get there. I simply don't want to get ahead of myself here. Okay, that's good. There we go. Just coming right along here. You'll have to forgive me a minute. All right. Coming along in terms of language, in verse 1 of chapter 11, this is Nimrod leading the people to what we call the Tower of Babel. And it says the whole earth was of one language. If you go back to chapter 10, you will find the term tongue. The word tongue means just that, tongue. It is one Hebrew word. Language is another Hebrew word, which means like English. Anybody ever seen the old film or play, My Fair Lady? Cute one. You know, talk about English over in England, you know. Over in America, they haven't spoken it for years, as she says. Well, in the play, we have the phrase, the rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain. So in proper English, it would be the rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain. And he's trying to teach this Cockney girl who always says the rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain. Well, over here in America, I remember when I first went south to the Mason-Dixon line, and I went into a store and he says, "Hi, y'all." "Y'all? It's just me." "What do you mean, y'all?" "Well, this is a tongue, okay? This is a dialect south of the Mason-Dixon line. You can go to Boston, where you pack your car and the habit yard. You can go to New York, the Bronx, where I came from, where it's hot on the 4th of July, and the water's fine. I mean, this is a dialect. That's all it is." That's Lashon. Lashon means dialect, and we translate it tongue, because Lashon means tongue in Hebrew. But language is the overall language. So God is scattering them. Now in verse 2, and this is where Fred asked me a question, going back months. And Fred, I think I've got an answer for you. But I'm ringing your cowbell, Fred. Okay, ringing your cowbell. It says, okay, it says, "And it came to pass as they traveled from the east." Now what does that mean? If you travel, all right, this is north, this is south, east, west. If I'm traveling from the east, I must be going west. I think. Not so fast. Not so fast. This is not clear. But let me give you another chapter where it is very clear. If you recall in the Christian Passover about Bein HaArba'im in Exodus 12, and then Fred pointed out the usage in Exodus 16, let's take a look in Genesis 13. If you will recall, this is the story where Abram and Lot and Sarai came up out of Egypt after going down, and they were wealthy, great prosperity. The land wasn't big enough to hold them both, so they're going to separate. And what we find is this. In verse 9, Abram is saying, "Is not the whole land before you? Separate. If you go to the left, I will go to the right." And it says, "And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was all well watered before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord. And Lot chose all the plain of Jordan for himself, and Lot journeyed east." Now, this phrase, "journeyed east," is mekadem, from the east. The exact same phrase that we found in Genesis 11, verse 2. Well, now, let's look at this map. Y'all see the map? Y'all see the map? Use your imagination. Here's north, south, east, west. Now, right here in the middle is where Abram and Lot were. Okay? If I'm going to go from the east, which way am I going? I'm going west. And what am I going to run into? The Mediterranean. Lot was not traveling west. So, from the east cannot mean from the east going west. Lot went east and south to the watered plain of the Jordan, where Sodom and Gomorrah were. Now, I didn't know this, but within this last year, Fred, I found an explanation that the Torah is also written in spiritual terms, not just physical terms. And metabolically speaking, the phrase, from the east, means away from God, away from the morality of God. Because what does the east symbolize? It symbolizes light. Remember an apostle named John who said, walk in the light as he is in the light? Remember the phrase, Jesus, the light of the world? When you leave the east, you're leaving the light of God. I cannot prove this, but this to me is the best example, the best answer. The light that Lot was leaving was Abram. Abram was the light of the world at that time. When God spoke, he spoke to Abram. He said, I know him. He will teach his children. He is my friend. Abraham was called the friend of God. That's where the light was. So he headed east. He headed east physically, but spiritually, it was away from. That's why it is translated Meh Adam. The Meh, the M, means away, out from. So he was going east, all right, and south, but he wasn't. But this is talking spiritually. You look at the translations, and what will they say? They will say eastward. But then in parenthesis, or down below, they will say, Hebrew says, from the east. And the scholars are scratching their heads, because they know very well that Lot went east, but yet the Hebrew says, from the east. So they just leave it like that. So when you go back to Genesis 11, what you're saying is, what we're saying here, is that Nimrod was leading the people from the light of God. And when Lot went to Sodom and Gomorrah, tell me, how much spiritual light do you think there was in Sodom and Gomorrah? Precious little, if any. But I also want you to think of something else. Sodom and Gomorrah, the plain of Jordan, was well watered. Try that today. There's not much water there. Remember Elisha and the hoodlums who mocked him, and two she-bears came out of the woods? No bears in Israel today, I'll guarantee you. Samson killing a lion? Lion? The topography, the geography was vastly different back then than it is today. That's just a little insight, that's all. But notice what it says further. They settled there, and they said to another, come, let us make bricks. Now that's interesting. And turn them, and they had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. Now I want to get out once again and read you the root letters of some of these words, and we'll find it rather interesting in the concept that is being presented here. First, we're going to go to verse 3. And they made bricks. Levanim. Okay, levanim. That is brick. And then they had, instead of la'aven. And the question I'm going to ask you, are you brick or are you stone? Because there's a very significant difference in God's eyes between bricks and stones. But we'll cover that in a couple of minutes. First of all, they had the bricks instead of stone, and they had also the word for mortar, which is chomer. Chomer is the word for mortar, and chemar is the word for the tar. Chemar, chomer. It's the same three root letters. This is materialism. In fact, you could translate it, they had materialism for materialism. Well, once again, what is Nimrod doing? Moving from the light and the spiritualness of God to this profanity, to this profaneness, materialism. His is a material empire. And that's exactly what he's doing. And that's exactly what the Hebrew is telling us. Now, what about this word brick and stone? It says they had brick instead of stone. God places great emphasis on stone. Let's go to Exodus 20, if I can get there quickly enough. Exodus chapter 20. And you will see something interesting. In fact, we're going to look at three or four scriptures, and we'll see something interesting. We're going to go to Exodus 20, and we're going to take a look at, as soon as I find my particular place here, We're going to particular find 24. And it says, you shall make an altar of earth to me, and shall sacrifice on it your burnt offerings, your peace offerings. And verse 25, if you will make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of cut stone. Brick is always cut. Brick is man-made. Nimrod's empire is man-made. It's brick. The Tower of Babel is considered brick. You don't go out anywhere, wherever you go, and find square or oblong bricks. You find stones. Large stones, small stones, thin stones, fat stones, it doesn't matter. These are whole stones. And God uses stones. In fact, who is the chief corner stone? Not corner brick. And what did Peter say about God's people? You are lively stones. What did Jesus say in Luke when he was riding into Jerusalem and the Pharisees were saying, rebuke your disciples. Don't you know what they're saying? And what did Jesus say? If they did not cry out, the stones would cry out. Why didn't he say bricks? Because God works with stones. In theory, we're all stones. God works with us. As I said, some great, some not so great. Naturally, through his spirit. But brick is chiseled. Now that doesn't mean I'm not speaking against bricks, you understand. You have a brick house, you can have a brick fireplace, a brick driveway. But when it comes to that which is spiritual, no. Because brick means, again, man-made. And stones are not man-made. God made the stones. And so we find, going back to Genesis 11, we find that that's exactly what God is telling us. He's telling us here, they had in verse 3, they had the brick for stone, they had asphalt for the mortar, and we have a good explanation that is the bitumen. But again, it's all material, and they're building a tower, and God stops it. Now what I have here, if I can find it, I thought I brought it up here. Yes, this is a pamphlet that I used from Daniel Lappin, who's a well-known rabbi. But in particular, he has a miniature of a poster. And this Tower of Babel to the left, and a miniature of the European Economic Community Parliament building. And it is almost verbatim. And this is an actual poster that was put out by Europe. And it says, Europe, many tongues, okay, many tongues, one voice, just as it was before the beginning of the Tower of Babel. The European system, no, Fred is right, I believe, that this coming beast power is not going to be the ones we've seen before. This is going to be something that goes clear back to the beginning. This is Nimrod. They're going back to Nimrod and the conditions before the flood, where you had different dialects, but one language, one voice. And this is their aim. And if you will look at the picture, I'll leave it up here so you can kind of look at it. I tried copying it, but it doesn't come across. You look at the people, and I'm telling you, they're made of brick. Man-made. Or it's like Legos. If you play with the Legos, you've seen kids playing with the Legos, how you connect them. Man-made. The coming system is a man, guided by the great adversary, of course, but the system is man-made, not God-made. God has nothing to do with it. And this is the whole lesson of Genesis 10 and Genesis 11 until the end of it, where God narrows down to one man who is going to be his servant and lead the fight against the system. And his name, of course, was Abram. And we know about Abram. That's not my point to bring that out this morning. We can do that another time. But this is fundamentally what was happening in Genesis 10 and Genesis 11. And an interesting sidelight, God is always pictured as a rival of tyrants. So Nimrod wanted to get away from God. What's the first thing you do when you want to bring a nation into slavery? You take away its moral fiber. You eliminate God. You drive him from the public square. You take the Ten Commandments out of the schools, out of everything. Because as long as you have the knowledge of God, as Horace Greeley, the famous editor back in the 19th century, said, it is impossible to enslave a Bible-speaking people. He says, you can't do it. Because people get strength from God as individuals, and they do not fall to tyrants. So Nimrod is the great one. And this is the thrust of Genesis 10 and Genesis 11. And that basically concludes the bulk of what I had in particular to bring this morning. Now, if anybody has any questions, of course, I'd be happy to answer them. I can go on to other areas, but this is the main area that I wanted to bring. Read and reread Genesis 10 and 11, and you will see the great rebellion and what's going to come full circle in the next, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, who knows, however much time God gives us. I mean, God can lengthen it out indefinitely. He's under no strict guidelines. He doesn't have to do anything to fit my schedule. I can have my chronology. I remember back in the old days at Ambassador College, and I had my chronology. Well, Fred, I'm sure, had his chronology, too. I had on the floor, now this is true, stretched from almost one end of the room to the other end of the room, and I had dates and chronology and who was born when and who died when, all the way down. And there's nothing. It turned out that God said, forget your chronology. I wish I had fully understood what God meant in Acts chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. You recall the time when the Israelites, or the few Israelites that were there, when Jesus was being called up to heaven, and they asked him just before that, will you at this time establish the kingdom to Israel? And in the Greek, and Fred can confirm more or less, but the force that I got out of it was, it's not your business or none of your business to know the times that the Father has reserved for himself. Don't get bogged down in chronology. Good, interesting, gives us insight, gives us maybe an overall framework of what we can expect. But God, but Jesus was saying, the Father will determine when he will do what it is he will do. And you cannot force him. In fact, it's interesting. Do you know one of the reasons why the Jews rebelled against Rome in AD 67, 68, 69? Fascinating. The zealots believed that God would always preserve and protect Jerusalem. Therefore, if they ignited a rebellion, God would be forced to come down from heaven and defend them against Rome. Now, that was their belief. And the truly great rabbis, I mean, not the rabid ones, said, you cannot force the hand of God. This is madness. They knew it was madness. But, see, God will determine when he will do things. So, while chronology is nice, and I've always been a great fan of chronology and historical records and genealogies and time frames, but always remember, God will not be bound by anybody's schedule. He will determine, again, I say, what he will do when he will do it. So, does anybody have any questions? Or yes?
Yeah, very interesting message and some excellent points. I question one thing. When you mentioned about the East being the presence of God, I wanted to, because I just know of a few scriptures, like in Isaiah 14 and in Psalms, where God resides in the north. Mm-hmm. And I thought of when Cain was exiled out of Eden, and I read in Genesis chapter 4, Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and lived in the land of Nod to the east of Eden. So he actually went to the east in Genesis 4, 16, which was away from the presence of the Lord.
Let's take Genesis what?
Chapter 4, verse 16.
Oh, this is saying, yes, in this case, it was east of Eden. It was just, this was giving a geographic location. See, that's true. This is just a geographic location. You've got to remember the difference between a geographic location and a spiritual condition. The phrase that is used that I was mentioning, Mekadem, meant away from the light of God. It wasn't giving a physical location. Oh, yeah, you could go east, okay? We know, as I said, that Lot went east or southeast to Sodom and Gomorrah. You're talking about a physical location. This is true. You are correct. What I was pointing out was the phrase Mekadem as it is used in these areas here, meant away from God's light, away from God's morality, away from his suzerainty. You're rebelling against him because the sun rises in the east. The sun banishes the darkness of night. So from a spiritual point of view, the east always represents light. And Lot left the light of God. He moved away from God's light because that's where Abram was. And Abram was the only man on earth, as far as we know, that truly acknowledged God. Abram was it. He really was. We don't realize, you know, Father Abraham. We don't call him Father Abraham for nothing. Father Abraham was a very important person. God loved Abraham. He said, I know him. He'll teach his children. And if you've ever read that section in Genesis, it's a masterpiece of diplomacy where God says to him, I've heard of the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah, and I've come down to see if it's really true. And then Abram begins his, you know, his discourse. What if you find 50? I will not destroy it for 50. Oh, but Lord, suppose 5 leap. I will not destroy it for 5. But perchance it's on 40 and 30 and 20 and 10. And then I've said to myself, humorously, God might have thought, I'm getting out of here before Abraham talks me out of the whole thing. It's a masterpiece of diplomacy. It really is. But no, you're correct. It is a physical location, but this was a spiritual condition. Yes. Well, only one was cast out. One was slaughtered. He would represent Christ. And then the other was anywhere. In fact, in the days of the Second Temple, they killed him. In the days of Moses, they just let him out into a fit place and let him wander.
Wandered.
Right. They took him out to the wilderness. There was no specific location. They just took him out to the wilderness. Yes. Abib, yes. Well, according to the story, you know, according to the legends that we have, the record that we have, and there's no way to actually prove it one way or the other, the answer is yes. According to the record, Abram was a regular visitor in Shem, with Shem, and with Noah. So Shem picked up information from Noah, obviously pre-flood. Sometimes you wonder, well, how did this all come about? How do you know all this? Because according to the record, which we cannot prove, but it makes sense to me, that Noah brought the records with him on the ark, the written records that he had, Genesis 1 largely. I do not believe that Moses wrote Genesis 1. I believe Moses was the editor of Genesis 1. He put in his important footnotes and incorporated them in. But the record, I believe, came from before the flood. And Noah brought those records, gave them to Shem. Abram was a visitor to Shem and comparing notes. And so Abram got a lot of his information and knowledge about God from Shem, who got it from Noah. According to the record, you are correct. It's just that I can't, you know, prove that historically.
Let me ask the other question. We're talking east and west and whatever. Left and right. Left is, I've heard it was evil. Left kind of represents evil as opposed to the right.
Well, the right because the right hand of God. Therefore, the left hand, yes, the left hand did indicate that which was not. I would have to look it up. Okay, look it up. Find it here and look it up and see what it is. But yeah, it's always the right hand of God. Another interesting concept too. The uniqueness. In Hebrew, there is no concept of luck, coincidence. It does not exist in Hebrew. It's either good or bad, right or wrong. Things happen for a reason. Things just don't plain happen. Now, yes, you do have time and chance happening to all, but it's not a Hebraic concept. And uniqueness, interestingly, as you know, is in the fingertips. It's in the fingertips. You can have identical twins. And yet, their fingertips are not the same, fingerprints. And that is why you'll find the phrase written by the finger of God. Because this is the uniqueness of God, the finger of God. It doesn't say written by the mind, although obviously everything came from the mind of God, we know. But when it came time to write it, it was written by the finger of God, his uniqueness. He put his unique stamp on everything he wrote or caused to be written. Yes. I don't think so. I think Fred gave a pretty good explanation in a way when it came to Adam and Eve and the gene and so forth. God just somehow interfered with the brain, with the mechanism, and it was quick, like that. Because otherwise, he said, look, this they begin to do. Nothing will be, they'll do anything. I've got to slow it down. So he slowed it down with languages. They were all speaking different dialects, but somehow he muddied the dialects. Or maybe it was with the tongue, maybe it was with the mouth that they started speaking gibberish to one another. But it had to do with something in the brain, the mouth, the tongue. Now, just what? I don't know. What combination? It'd be interesting to know, but I plead ignorance. Okay, Fred was pointing out that it was a geographical translation of that. Right. The Hebrew word is mekedem, from the east. Now, we do not know for sure which physical direction they were traveling. And when Fred asked me, well, where were they traveling from? And I tell you now, I didn't know. And I still can't say with absolute certainty, but I can say with maybe 90% certainty that it's talking about a spiritual condition. And you'll find this. God said, here a little, there a little. And sometimes he intersperses phrases that must be understood spiritually and not physically. I gave the illustration back up in Hollister about reasoning, deductive versus inductive reasoning. And you can pretty much catch it on that tape if you've got it. Basically, inductive reasoning, as I'm sure you all know, has to do with you examine the facts. You get all the facts together and see what kind of a conclusion that you point to. And I gave the example of Allentown, Pennsylvania, and the Armenian. This is a classic example that's given. I did not make this up. This is an actual example given of inductive reasoning. You want to know whether or not to give a certain person an invitation to an Armenian party. And it's going to take place in the town of Allentown. And you find out that in Allentown, 90% of the people are not Armenian. Only 10% are. So what's your indication? Is he Armenian? Are you going to give him an invitation? Well, you further find out that he belongs to the Armenian club. Well, this changes things. Chances are he's an Armenian, isn't he, if he belongs to the Armenian club? But then you find out that 90% of the people at the club are Armenian. 10% are not. So, is he Armenian or not? Well, you don't know. The preponderance of evidence says yes. But is the preponderance of evidence absolute? No. Now, deductive reasoning is you start out with an assumption. Logicians call them givens. You can call them hypothesis. I like the word assumption myself, but you can call it any word you want. So in deductive reasoning, you assume something. Now, if you assume something, then you go ahead and you ask your questions. You look at all the evidence. And can you properly interpret the evidence in the light of your assumption? If it makes sense, then you logically conclude it's true. Of course, if your assumption is wrong, you can be wrong. But in this case, using deductive logic and assuming that, no, this is referring to a spiritual condition, it makes sense. If I assume its physical location, I'm blown apart. How can I say Mekedem, which means away from the east going west, when clearly Lot went east? It doesn't make sense. From a physical location, geographic location, it's got to mean a spiritual location, because then it makes sense. He went away from the light of God to what? To darkness, which was Sodom and Gomorrah. And this is the lesson that God is trying to teach us in the Torah. As I gave an example of a rabbi many years ago, he said, listen, stand back. Don't assume. Stand back. Ask yourself, what is the Torah trying to tell you? Only I paraphrase it and said, instead of thinking, what is the Torah trying to tell me, what is God through the Torah trying to tell me? What knowledge is he trying to impart to me? And he said, then make your decision. Think. So I'm thinking, and I'm saying, in the example of Lot with Abram, it cannot be a physical location. Impossible. It must mean spiritual condition. Yes. Mm-hmm. No. I could give you an explanation for that. This is written from like a historian's point of view. If you've ever read a history of the United States or any country, what you will find is chapter so-and-so will talk about the economic history from 1800 to 1850. Then next chapter will talk about the military history from 1800 to 1850. And you actually, this is contemporary. But each one is giving a different aspect of the story. Genesis 1 is giving you the overall view of the creation. The animals were created first. Then God created man, and then he created Eve. But he didn't create Eve at exactly the same time. That's where Genesis 2 comes in. Genesis 2 is going to fill in the details. It's going to fill in some gaps. So that God created the animals, then he created Adam, then he brought the animals to Adam to see what he would call them. And then God said, you know, it's not good for man to be alone. So then he created Eve from Adam. But Genesis 1 is in magnificent poetry. See, it's imagery, and Hebrew is rich in imagery. As an example, read in Judges, is it 5 and 6 or 4 and 5, of Sisera and the rebellion, and God is going to help destroy Sisera, the Israelites, gain their freedom from Sisera. And you read where in beautiful, magnificent poetry, he talks about Sisera. The stars in heaven fought against him. He fell. He sank. He died. That didn't happen. Sisera was running away, scared to death. He sees Yael, and he runs into Yael. Oh, come, my little king, come and let mama, he'll comfort you. And then she takes the peg and bashes his brains in. Read the story. But you see, there are two different accounts. One is a magnificent poetic account of what happened. Well, Genesis 1 is the same way. It's magnificent Hebrew poetry. Now, it's accurate. It's accurate. Then Genesis 2 brings in the details of how each aspect fits in to Genesis 1, if that helps. Well, I think I've about run out of time here, Fred.
For our overseas offices, please check our website, www.cbcg.org.